Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group. And every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Midcoast Radio Project, Incorporated.
Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart, and you just heard Amy Bell reading our mantra. And our guest in the studio today is returning from November 29th, Teresa Wilkie, an investigator with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The EEOC is going to talk to us about sexual harassment. But first, we're going to hear Women's E-News from Amy.
Cheers and jeers from Women's E-News. In cheers, a transgender Dalit in central India has become the country's first transgender to be elected mayor, Agency France Press reported in January 5th. Madhu Bhai Kinar won the municipal election in Raigarh in the central state of Chhattisgarh. Kinar, a member of the caste previously known as Untouchables, had been earning a living by singing and dancing on trains. The Press Trust of India reported, but she stopped when she was asked to represent her community. More news to cheer this week. A new law in Illinois aims to protect new mothers and expecting mothers in the workplace. The Illinois Pregnancy Fairness Law took effect on January 1st. KSDK reported on January 3rd. The law creates pregnancy as a protected classification under Illinois law, said Amy Blaisdell, a labor and employment attorney who practices in Missouri and Illinois. That means women who are pregnant, who are applying for jobs, or who are employed in the state of Illinois, private employers included, are protected from discrimination as well as retaliation for requesting accommodation. The UK's Labour Party will target the 9 million women who did not vote in the last general election after new figures indicated that more women than men have turned their backs on politics, The Independent reported January 7th. The party will publish a manifesto for women, which will include childcare, help for older women who have to work as well as juggle childcare duties as grandparents, domestic violence, equal pay, and women's representation in areas such as public life and business. Gina Davis is starting the Bentonville Film Festival, a festival designed to promote female and minority filmmakers that will be the only competition in the world to guarantee theatrical distribution for the winners, Time reported January 7th. Intel pledged $300 million to encourage women and minorities to join the tech sector, Wired reported January 7th. In jeers, House Republicans are renewing their effort to ban abortion after the first 20 weeks of pregnancy on the disputed premise that fetuses feel pain at that stage, The Hill reported January 6th. On the first day of the new Congress, Reps Trent Franks, Republican from Arizona, and Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, reintroduced legislation to stop women from terminating pregnancies after 4.5 months. The bill, known as the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, previously passed the House in June 2013. In addition, Texas abortion rights advocates were in a U.S. appeals court on January 7th to challenge state abortion restrictions they say are aimed more at shutting clinics than in protecting women's health, Reuters reported January 5th. A panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans convened to consider whether a requirement under Texas law for abortion clinics to have certain hospital-like settings for surgeries is warranted. Doctors would need to provide women more information about pregnancies and abortions before performing an abortion if a bill filed January 7th in the Tennessee General Assembly becomes law, the Tennessean reported. The informed consent proposal comes from State Senator May Beavers, a Republican from Montana, and would restore a law that was in effect in Tennessee before a 2000 state Supreme Court ruling that drastically changed abortion laws in the state. Many women living in surrounding states with abortion restrictions seek care in Tennessee. Against this backdrop, a Guttmacher report found that the number of states considered extremely hostile to abortion rights has more than tripled over the past 4 years. The number of states with at least a half dozen abortion restrictions rose from 5 in 2010 to 18 in 2014, the Washington Post reported. The number of simply hostile states, those with at least 4 abortion restrictions on record, has risen from 13 in 2000 to 22 in 2010 to 27 in 2014. More news to JIRR this week. New Orleans Saints outside linebacker Junior Gallette has been charged with domestic violence, simple battery, following an arrest at his Kenner home January 5th, USA Today reported. 6 women are murdered every day in Mexico, Al Jazeera America reported, quoting figures of the National Citizen Femicide Observatory, a coalition of 43 groups that document the crime. Yet only 24% of the 3,892 femicides the group identified in 2012 and 2013 were investigated by authorities, and only 1.6% led to sentencing. The Saudi Ministry of Interior issued a ban on women running spas, beauty centers, and women's sports facilities, the Saudi Gazette reported January 4th. Reacting to the ban, businesswomen in the industry demanded authorities reconsider. The businesswomen said the ban has caused them great losses and put them under much stress. Noted, California Senator Barbara Boxer, a standard bearer of liberal politics who has served in Congress for more than 3 decades, announced January 8th she will not run for another term, the Los Angeles Times reported. Boxer has been an unyielding advocate for women's rights groups, among other progressive causes. 2 women accusing Bill Cosby of sexual offenses decades ago have joined a defamation lawsuit, the Associated Press reported January 6th. Cosby publicly branded them as liars through statements by his representatives. A woman-only minibus service has been launched in Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, to reduce sexual harassment on the city's frequently overcrowded routes, BBC News reported January 5th.
Jaws of Justice Radio invites local lawyers in to give us a rundown on some of the most important legal stories of 2014. Tune in and see if you agree. Jaws of Justice Radio, 9 a.m. Monday, right after Democracy Now!
Happy New Year's, everyone. This is Richard Mabian. Be sure to tune in to Eco Radio this Monday as we discuss the transportation problems caused by the movement of goods in Kansas City and beyond. Eric Kirkendall from the newly forming MOCAN Clean Air Coalition will be our guest. That's Monday, January the 12th from 6 to 7 on KKFI 90.1 FM.
Great. Now we'll continue with Teresa Wilkie with EEOC. She's an investigator and has some interesting and I think shocking and revealing subject material, which we must be very careful, by the way, that we can't say some of these words. It's appalling to me what you told me on the telephone, how some women are talked to at work.
Maybe we should give that little disclaimer before we get started about
calling in. Yes. You going to do that, Amy, or are we going to have Teresa do that?
There are FCC rules which prohibit word and broadcast content, and some of the words that I note are commonly used at work and that employees complain to the EEOC about would violate those broadcast content rules. So we encourage everyone to call KKFI today. And if you call, please be careful not to use the particular words. George Carlin's 7 deadly words is a classic way of expressing it, so that we don't have to punch holes in the broadcast today.
And, Amy, do you want to give that telephone number?
Yeah, you can call in at 816-931-5534. We are going to be talking about harassment at work and kind of a little bit more about the details about what some women are experiencing. And men can experience this too. If you would like to call in and share your story that may have to be a little bit censored, you please call us at 816-931-5534.
And Teresa will perhaps be able to give a little bit of advice and counsel. Okay.
Okay, well, I want to thank Sharon and Amy for having me on Every Woman today. This is my second broadcast. I'm an investigator with the United States Government Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and very happy to be here. We enforce laws that protect persons from discrimination because of their race, sex, color, national origin, religion, age over 40, and disability. And we like to communicate those laws and have dialogue about it. I want everyone who's listening to know that you can contact EEOC if you have questions about discrimination in your employment. You can call EEOC's number at 800-669-4000. 800-669-4000. We have people walk into our office Monday through Friday from the hours of 8 o'clock until 4:15 if they would like to meet with an investigator and discuss their employment problem. Our office is located at 400 State Avenue, STATE, in Kansas City, Kansas. That's the Gateway Tower 2 building, and we're on the 9th floor. The telephone number for the office is 913-551-5655. All right. Today I'm going to talk to everyone about sex harassment at work, and I'll start by saying the protection against sex harassment at employment comes out of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and Title VII does not prescribe all conduct of a sexual nature in the workplace. The Supreme Court said in a Supreme Court decision on Cawley versus Offshore Drilling Company, Title VII is not a general civility code. So it's impossible to say what is sexual harassment and what isn't sex harassment. And I'll try to explain the dilemma. It has to be unwelcome. It's got a subjective component. So that sets up a situation where the same person at work can say the same thing to two different individuals, and one individual might find that unwelcome, and the other doesn't find it to be unwelcome. So that's not harassment toward the individual who does not find it unwelcome. It is harassment toward the individual who finds it unwelcome. Although it's the same kind of talk or action.
So is this something like one woman might find something a compliment and another woman may find it of an inappropriate nature?
True that. However, with respect to compliments, I'll talk in my discussion about, in order to be harassment, a complaint has to be about something that is egregious or offensive. So to say to, for example, a woman, "Gee, you look nice today," applying the reasonable person standard to that comment, most reasonable people would not find that to be an offensive comment. "You look nice today."
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of complimenting something that might be one of the words on your seven deadlies list.
If sexual harassment involves conduct which is sexual, that's the first step. And generally, in order to be sexual harassment, it has to be sexual. In order to be harassment, it has to be unwelcome. In order to be actionable harassment, it needs to be frequent, severe, or egregious, which is just a $10 word for severe, and offensive. Generally offensive to a reasonable person. So those are the criteria. That's the animal.
Let me say, I'm thinking back on some of the things I heard as a younger woman from probably younger men, because they would tend to be more bold, as, gosh, you look nice today. Bend over so I can see some more. Or, gosh, you look nice today. Let's have sex.
I like the gosh that was added in that sentence.
Oh, well, maybe they didn't say gosh.
That's exactly my example. Gosh, you look nice today is not going to be actionable harassment. The bend over, let me see what's under your dress, or talk about any private part of a coworker or subordinate employee's anatomy is not appropriate. Is not that's severe. That kind of comment is severe. Okay, now the law has come to define generally two types of sex harassment. The first, quid pro quo. That's a Latin term meaning this for that. And to explain a situation where there is quid pro quo sexual harassment, that is a work situation where submission to sexual conduct is made either explicitly or implicitly a term or condition of employment. That can be a single event. Classically, a quid pro quo situation is where a boss says to a female subordinate, if you have sex with me, I'll promote you. Or, if you don't have sex with me, I will fire you. Have sex with me, then I will promote you. Don't have sex, then I will fire you. That's quid pro quo. The other type of sex harassment is hostile or abusive. Hostile and abusive are synonymous. A hostile work environment. Hostile work environment claims are not quite as particular to a person, do this or I will do that. It can be a larger general term of your employment, where you go to work and then you have to hear people talking about sex, talking about how you look in personal, inappropriate ways, and it has to be severe and pervasive enough to alter the terms of a person's employment and create an abusive work environment. So a hostile environment needs to happen on more than one occasion. It needs to be frequent in order to be harassment. In other words, if you get a job and someone one time says, gee, you look nice today, bend over so I can see more of you, one time, and never says it again, and you work there for 10 years, that's not going to be actionable. But if every time you come to work, so-and-so says, bend over, let me look at you, then that is harassment. It's frequent. It's egregious. As I referenced earlier, the comments or actions have to be unwelcome. Now, the reason there is a welcomeness component to sexual harassment is because some people have sex and talk in sexy ways to each other, and it's not unwelcome. It's a relationship, and that's not against the law. So the person who wants to complain about sex harassment has to feel that it is unwelcome. And from my experience, one of the more difficult investigations involving sexual harassment involves a situation that has some aspect of relationship between two people, where the relationship is on again and off again, or the person making the complaint of sex harassment says, well, it was welcome on Monday, but it wasn't welcome on Tuesday, and it was welcome Thursday and Friday. That, if there's a sexual relationship with a boss or a coworker, and if that relationship ends so that sexual talk and actions become to the employee to be harassing, the employee in that circumstance needs to clearly communicate that the sexual relationship has ended, and further talk about familiarity between the two is unwelcome. It has to be a clear communication. And
they have to communicate that to the boss or
to the harasser, whomever. Mm-hmm, to the harasser.
Before they can file a complaint.
It's not fair to the person being charged with sex harassment if the purported victim of sex harassment has engaged in that same kind of behavior and did not think it was harassment. Mm-hmm. At the point they believe, I don't want this kind of behavior to happen anymore, they need to say that and stick to it. It's very difficult then to go to EEOC or to a lawyer and complain about a person's behavior, because there are not general laws that supervise how people behave.
Well, that was one question that I wanted to ask you, is that a lot of places I know that I've had employment at, there were more clear-cut policies in the employee handbook than what you're talking about. So to me, it seems like a lot of companies have this under a lot more tight control, and it can, for most people who work in a place of employment like that, seem like something that really isn't able to happen anymore, isn't something that, you know, you would even be necessary, because these employee handbooks go beyond what the government's able to do.
However, I will tell you from my experience, I filed a hostile environment lawsuit, and it had nothing to do about sexual favor. It was about being treated hostily as the sole woman in a male-dominated industry, and not being invited to sales meetings, not being invited to golf outings, not being included in conversation around the office. Strictly it was hostile. And, in fact, to the point that the female sales assistants felt, you know, they early on they came to me and told me, oh my gosh, we can't believe this man hired a woman. This is unbelievable. But it got to the point where, to protect their jobs, they had to side with the males. I had an assistant try to slam my hand in a file drawer once because I was trying to get my own sales literature, which was something she should have done for me. And she wasn't going to do it, but she wasn't going to let me do it either. So, you know, that's just another. And the rules, like you say, are very clear in many, many places, but that doesn't mean they're followed.
I've come to talk to the public today about rules, the EEOC's guidance, and our very first guidance on the subject of sex harassment was written in 1980, coming out of the 70s, and the footnotes cite court cases of sex harassment. Typically, those cases were men sexually harassing women. All of them were men sexually harassing women. That is not true today. We have cases where women sexually harass men. We have cases where men sexually harass men and women sexually harass women. However, that early compliance manual section written in the 1970s from court cases in the 1970s would curl your hair how people behaved at work. And so much employers had to pay a lot of money to resolve those lawsuits, and employers learned to put policies in place and to clearly communicate those policies. And today, in the wide world of sex harassment, it is really not as frequently occurring as it did in the 70s and 80s. And obviously there were fewer women employed in the 60s, 50s, 40s, or women tended to be segregated. Women only worked with other women, men only worked with other men. However, just because there are laws against it and it happens less frequently, it still does happen. That has taught me, as an EEOC investigator, that it's good to have a law in place. It really does change behavior at the workplace, but it doesn't completely remove the phenomena of sex harassment, and that's because people just feel things and do it. I feel sex, I do sex. I feel harassment, I do harassment, without thinking about, well, gee, is that against the law? Okay, now, I wanted to talk about welcomeness. I had referenced that earlier. It has to be unwelcome. And I wanted to raise the point about voluntariness, because the big Supreme Court cases had to really determine whether submission to sexual activity, a voluntary acquiescence to sexual activity, made it welcome. And that's because we have seen where typically a woman at work has to have sex with a boss in order to keep the job and to have the job be halfway something she can do to make a living, to support her family, etc., etc. Just because she does it doesn't mean it's welcome. So she might be voluntarily submitting even to have sex with a coworker or a supervisor. That doesn't make it welcome to her. So the question is whether toleration of sex harassment, it's not welcome, is made a condition of employment. And when there is some indication of welcomeness, or when there's the credibilities of the parties is at issue, a victim's claim will be considerably strengthened if he or she made a contemporaneous complaint or protest. In other words, it's not at all unusual in a sex harassment investigation for the person making the complaint to say, "I was sexually harassed," and then the person being accused of harassing says, "I did not harass." So there's a credibility issue, and it has to be proved. Now, if the victim of sex harassment says, "I was sexually harassed, and I went that same day and made a complaint in writing, dated it, and kept a copy, and hands it to me as an EEOC investigator," that's pretty credible evidence compared to the alleged harasser who just says, "I didn't do it," then that there isn't any evidence to support them.
But this seems like it could be subjected to very similar hesitations of reporting that is in sexual assault outside of the workplace. Is there any real solutions to making that something that women have more protection from if they're afraid?
I think the commonality you see is because in circumstance of sexual harassment, there frequently are no witnesses. People who engage in sex harassment are smart enough to do it when there's no one watching. And so frequently when I'm investigating a complaint of sex harassment, I'm not going to have an eyewitness. And the best I can do is if I can find other people who were subjected to the same kind of sexual behavior by the same harasser who give me testimony, or people that the victim of sex harassment that same day said, "That coworker has sexually harassed me," and they give me testimony that they had a complaint, or even a friend or family member who can be a contemporaneous witness to an incident of sex harassment, then it doesn't really make any difference that the alleged harasser maintains his innocence, because it's just been overcome by more evidence that it did happen than there's evidence that it didn't happen.
Is recording conversation, if you're continually subjected to it, is it a good idea to have a recorder on your person?
It's very interesting on the subject of recording evidence. It always reminds me, a question like that always reminds me of Rosemary Woods and the Nixon Watergate tapes, where Nixon went through the cassette tape recordings and blanked some parts out, and so the court said, oh, well, cassette tapes are not best evidence. And tapes, for purposes of a lawsuit, may not be the best evidence. Now, since Watergate, the world has come very up to speed at looking to see where there are cuts in tapes and other types of digital recordings. And it is a real phenomena of sex harassment at work. People are frequently photographed. Employers have cameras on work sites, and many times they're going. And individuals have cameras and video cameras on them and their cell phone. And those will take pictures, and they will take audio record. That's very good evidence. It's not the best as an admission. That would be the best evidence, is where the harasser says, oh, yeah, well, I got caught. Mm-hmm. But it's very good evidence, yes. Okay, so there is employer liability when sex harassment is by a supervisor or a manager, an absolute liability. When the alleged harassment is by a coworker, the employer is not absolutely liable for it unless the employer knew or should have known that the coworker was acting in a sexual harassing way toward the victim of sex harassment. There's more liability by the employer when the harassment is by a supervisor, and certainly when the harassment is by a proxy, such as an owner, a member of the board, the president of the corporation. There's an affirmative defense for employers from charges of sex harassment if it's a two-prong test to the affirmative defense. The first is that the employer took reasonable care to prevent sex harassment at work. Amy, this is what you're referencing, how in the modern world there's lots of good, strong policy against harassment. This comes out of our guidance, which comes out of the court cases, the Supreme Court cases on sex harassment. The employer needs to raise the subject of sex harassment, express explicit policy against sex harassment, continuously express strong disapproval of sex harassment, and develop appropriate sanctions. They need to train employees how to complain, how to make a complaint of sex harassment, and investigate complaints of sex harassment promptly, make victims whole, and in general do what's necessary to end harassment and make follow-up inquiries of their employees.
And now there's protection from retaliation, too, isn't there? If you file a complaint and the complaint goes nowhere, but you're retaliated against, that could be a stronger case than the original sexual harassment complaint. Am I right?
You're absolutely right, and that's very good advice. If people listening would happen to be an employer, be careful you don't punish the person complaining of sex harassment. There is a right to complain of sex harassment. We already talked when we began the program today that some people are subjected to comments that they find harassing that generally a reasonable person would not find to be harassment. But if you have an employee come to you and say, my coworker said I look nice today and I think it's sex harassment, you cannot punish that employee if they're making a knowing, sincere complaint that's protected. So you can't punish an employee for making a complaint of sex harassment.
Could you tell us some of the things that you typically hear from people on your daily work?
Well, and while we're talking about some examples, let me remind everyone that the call-in number is 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. And we would love to hear any stories that you have. They don't have to be recent. Just your experience maybe dealing with the EEOC or going through a harassment situation that possibly you've been scared to report or whatever your circumstance is.
I'm really not at liberty to discuss cases. All charges are protected by the Privacy Act, and I can talk about lawsuits. And I did get a fact pattern for the Supreme Court cases having to do with sex harassment so that we can talk about what happened to those people where the cases went to the Supreme Court. But before we do that, I wanted to finish my affirmative defense for employers. I said it's two prongs. An employer is not liable for sex harassment if, number one, they took reasonable care to prevent sex harassment. And as I said, this is why in employment, it's as Amy experiences, where there's talk about sex harassment and people are clearly told, we don't do sex harassment here, and if it does happen, here's how to complain. Okay, the second prong is that the victim of sex harassment failed to complain or take advantage of preventative opportunities. Now, an affirmative defense with respect to the law has to be proved by the employer. So the way the charge process goes, the person complaining of sex harassment has to prove the sex harassment. But if the employer wants to make an affirmative defense, I'm not guilty because I had a policy or the person failed to complain, they have to prove that. They can't just say it, they have to prove. So on that first prong, the employer policy, there needs to be a prohibition against harassment. There needs to be protection against retaliation. There needs to be an effective complaint process. There needs to be confidentiality. There needs to be an effective investigative process. As I said, there are not always witnesses to sex harassment. So include asking people who the victim of sex harassment said she told of the harassment. An effective investigative process is asking who, what, when, where, how. Okay, an employer ought to thoroughly interview the person making the complaint. They should thoroughly interview the harasser. They should thoroughly interview any identified third parties. And interview these people separately and take notes and then compare their testimony to try to determine credibility. That's how we determine what happened. Reach a determination and finally give assurance of immediate and appropriate corrective action. Now, the second prong of the affirmative defense is the employee duty to exercise avoidance. So your employer's got a policy against sex harassment, and it says if you feel you're sexually harassed, go complain like this. So if you want to make a complaint about sex harassment, you have to complain. And a failure to complain removes liability from your employer. We will consider reasons why a victim of sex harassment may have failed to complain. Number one is the risk of retaliation. Number two, obstacles to complaints. Let's say they say, if you're sexually harassed, complain to Joe Blow, but Joe Blow is the person who's sexually harassing you. Well, then that's an obstacle to your complaint. Finally, there is the perception at work that complaining is ineffective. So if you have known other employees who have complained of sex harassment and nothing ever came of it, that would tend to make people not complain. Now then, on the fact patterns of some of the things that have happened to people at work, which are sex harassment, the first case having to do with sex harassment that went to the Supreme Court, 1986, Meritor Savings Bank versus Vinson. This is at a bank, and the victim of sex harassment, the plaintiff, was a secretary for a bank officer who asked her to have sex, would pull her skirt up, say, "I want to look at your legs," grab her rear end, grab other parts of her body, talk to her about her sex life, talk to her about his sex life, and this was all unwelcome, and it went to court, and it went to the Supreme Court. In the Harris versus Forklift Systems, this was a case more where the woman was told, "You can't do this job as well as a man. All women are good for is to have sex. All women are good for is to shake their bodies." And it was only Harris versus Forklift Systems were only comments. There was nothing physical, but the comments were frequent. They were about sex. They were demeaning. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 1993, the Supreme Court said that the plaintiff does not have to prove a concrete psychological harm to establish a Title VII violation. So if you're subjected to that kind of behavior at work, and you say, "Well, that really bothers me, and it doesn't stop," you can file a complaint and you can file a lawsuit, and you don't have to show that it made you crazy or that you were institutionalized as a result of it or that it made you physically ill. If a reasonable person would agree that that was sexual and it was offensive and it went on and didn't stop, that's actionable. Now, the Supreme Court in...
So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Harris.
Harris, yes.
Okay. And in the first case, the plaintiff also?
Yes.
Okay. We need to take a break for a brief station promotions.
Support for 90.1 FM provided by Communiversity. They have classes in wheel throwing, Spanish bagpiping, parenting parrots, and tons more. You can Google Communiversity/UMKC, or you can call 816-235-1407 for more info and discover the world of possibilities that Communiversity has to offer.
Is the deluge of money unleashed by recent Supreme Court decisions connected to U.S. failure to address critical issues for building a better future for this country? Linda Vogel-Smith, who's the president of the League of Women Voters in Kansas City, will address the effects of money in politics on a range of issues like climate change, voting rights, public education, student debt, and gun control. This Wednesday at noon on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
Our guest today is Teresa Wilkie, an investigator with the EEOC, and would invite you to call in and share. I know you've got to have stories out there. This is an ongoing issue that happens frequently in the workplace. Call 816-931-5534 to ask Teresa questions or to share your story, just watching the bad words that we can't say over the air.
And I would say keep in mind, too, that while it can be hard to share these stories sometimes, it could be very helpful to other women who are kind of at a spot where they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to take that leap into pursuing action on the harassment they're experiencing.
I was talking about a few court cases where, Sharon, you asked me for some specifics about behavior at work that was considered sexual harassment. So there's a classic Supreme Court opinion, 1998, Farragher versus the City of Boca Raton. The fact pattern in that case, Beth Ann Farragher was a lifeguard for the City of Boca Raton, and she worked at a beach in Louisiana, she and other women. And these women would have to wear a particular swimming suit in their watch on the beach, and then they had a small beach house. It was just a concrete block facility to use the restroom to change their back into their street clothes from being on the beach all day. And this was a seasonal job. It was a summer job. But year after year, these women would go to work as lifeguards, and men would try to see them change their clothes and would steal their clothes so that they couldn't get properly dressed again at the end of the day, and would pull on their clothes to try to make them expose themselves. And with reference again to your talking about the modern day advent of electronic recording of people, everyone needs to be aware that sex harassers can videotape you or use their cell phone to record you in all kinds of compromising ways. This can happen. This can be part of the sex harassment behavior at work. So then there's a very, on the other side of the coin, there is a case that went to the Supreme Court, Ellerth versus Burlington Industries. This is 1997. Kim Ellerth quit because she allegedly suffered sex harassment by her supervisor. Despite her refusals of her supervisor's advances, she did not suffer any tangible retaliation, and she was, in fact, promoted once. Moreover, while she remained silent about the sex harassment conduct, despite her knowledge that Burlington had a policy against sex harassment, she still sued Burlington, claiming the company forced her to quit. So this went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it is from that case that we get this calling the employer to have a policy and saying if a person does not complain, that's part of the affirmative defense. Now, the suffering, the tangible employment action, if you feel like you're harassed and because of the harassment you suffer a tangible employment action, you have to quit so you lose income, you're fired so you lose income, you're not promoted, you're given a less desirable job, those type of cases are more actionable than a complaint that, well, it just didn't make me feel good, but I continued to go to work, I worked my way up the ranks at work. And that just has to do with damages. And then I don't want to spend the hour without referencing again the Oncalli versus Sundowner Offshore Services. This was a classic sex harassment complaint. Oncalli was a man that worked on an offshore drilling site. There's only men at the employment situation. Other men would grab him by the hips from behind and shake his hips toward their hips. That's kind of a classic sex harassment activity. They would pinch his chest. They would say things about his body. They would pat his face, say things about his body. And that had to go to the Supreme Court because that's a 1998 case, but there was some argument that sex harassment was not actionable unless there was a man and a woman, a difference in the sex. And this was a case where there was no difference in the sex, but it was still sexual. And Oncalli said, yes, that's sex harassment. it's interesting to note that we do see sex harassment where the women are the alleged harassers and the victims are male and female. In my personal experience, that's fairly rare. It is much more common for a man to complain that another man has sexually harassed him. There's all kinds of reasons for that. Men might not find sexual behavior to be unwelcome, for example, so that if a woman made sexual activity toward a man at work, he would say, oh, and I like that, and he wouldn't complain. I just wanted to say a couple of good business practices. So, as I said before, if you have a company and someone complains of sex harassment, please be careful. Don't punish the complainant. They're protected in their right to complain. Employers, take good records. Well, frankly, victims of harassment, take good records. Keep dates. If you make a complaint of sex harassment, make it in writing. Keep a copy for yourself. Date the day you gave it to your employer. Employer, same thing about records goes to you.
And who was present and whom you might have shared it with.
True. Employers, even if you can't prove an allegation of sex harassment, an employee comes to you and says, Joe Blow sexually harassed me, and you investigate, and Joe Blow says, I didn't do it, and there's no witnesses. Employer, it would be a good practice to give Joe Blow a written memorandum. Today, so-and-so made a complaint that you subjected her to sex harassment, and put it in his file. Because what we see is sex harassers are sometimes habitual or repeat performers, and they're smart enough to not do it where people can see them, but they'll do it again and again and again. So the first victim of sex harassment, you might not be able to prove that it happened, but if another victim comes and you have the first victim's complaint in Joe Blow's file, that's some evidence that Joe Blow is sexually harassing employees. Okay, remove sexual graffiti from the workplace. And certainly in the hour I've talked, my talk about harassment has application for race harassment too. Employers, remove racial or sexual harassment at the workplace. Keep track of supervisor conduct. Screen your applicants for supervisory positions. Check their backgrounds from earlier employment. And finally, past conduct of a victim of harassment offered to show welcomeness must pertain to the harasser, not to someone else. So it's perfectly legal for people to be sexually active with others at work. And the fact that a person complaining of sex harassment may have had sex with another coworker, not one they're complaining about, is not evidence that she was not sexually harassed by this other person. Just because she's sexually active is not evidence that she was not harassed, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, can you give us the contact information one more time before we have to move on today?
If you have any questions or would like to talk to the EEOC, we're at 400 State Avenue, Suite 905, Kansas City, Kansas. You can call our call center by dialing 800-669-4000.
Thank you very much for coming on the show to talk with us about this today.
Thanks for having me.
I still have lots of questions. I just don't understand male-on-male harassment. I get the female, male-to-female. I just don't get the male-to-male. But another time, perhaps, I'll have to give this some consideration.
Thank you very much.
Well, to make it easier for you to understand if it's sexual, and if it's unwelcome, it's harassment.
I know about, sometimes I wonder just about life, I guess. It's like the inappropriate behavior. Some of the things you said to me the other night on the telephone, I was just aghast. I don't know if I said this. I was married to an alcoholic. I was called everything under the sun. But I haven't been called those words at work. The worst I've been called is a bitch to my face. What they said behind my back is none of my business. But anyway, okay, sexual harassment, it is a big issue. And they should call the EEOC and find out what rights they have as employees. Thanks, Teresa.
Thanks. And we're going to move on. We do have one calendar item that we did want to announce today, and that is the Greater Kansas City Women's Political Caucus General Meeting is Thursday, January 22nd from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., and a City Council Candidate Forum at All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri, 64111.